In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, I'm going to be talking to Sean Ellis about hacking customer acquisition. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 337. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Sean.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Sean?
I'm doing great, Mike. How are you doing?
Good, good. Haven't talked to you in a while.
Yeah, it has been a while.
I think the last time we were in a room in person, it was back in MicroConf 2011. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And when in Vegas, you don't really remember too many conversations that you have because there's so much stuff going on there.
Do you remember the hot sauce incident?
I don't.
Oh, okay. yes, hot sauce flew from the stage. So anyway, we'll skip over that. So wanted to have you on the show to talk about a new book that you're coming out with, and it's called Hacking Growth, which I think it comes out pretty soon. This episode goes live on the 25th, and it's right about that time, right?
That is the day it comes out. Perfect.
Yes, it's a fortuitous Tuesday, I guess we'll call that. So to give the listeners an intro to you, though, you were the growth marketing executive at Dropbox, Eventbrite, Lookout, LogMeIn, Uproar, and you were like one of the first people hired in a marketing capacity at each of those companies. Is that correct, if I remember correctly?
That is correct. Eventbrite would be the only one where there was actually somebody already doing marketing when I got there, but all the others, it was primarily engineers, and I came in and started thinking about how to grow those businesses.
Got it. And then you were also the founder of Qualaroo, and which you sold off last year, if I remember correctly, right?
That's right. Yeah, we sold that February, March of last year and had a good run for a few years, but really wanted to focus our efforts on growth hackers.
Yep. And that's where you're the CEO at today. It's growthhackers.com. There's a fairly large community there. And then you also coined the term growth hacker back in 2010.
Yep. That was for better or worse. Some people love it and some people hate it. But I guess the good news there is that very few people ignore it, that it's evoking emotion.
Yes, it does. And I have heard mixed feelings on that. So I guess straight from the source, how do you define growth hacker? Like, what does it mean to you and how do you explain it to people?
Yeah, so for me, it's about rapid experimentation across all of the growth levers. So it's really those growth levers sit across the customer journey, where to contrast that against just marketing, marketing is generally externally focused. So it's looking only at acquisition. And growth hacking is about just anything that's important for driving growth in the business, you're experimenting in those areas. And the fact is that most of the really powerful levers actually sit in the product team's area. And so that's I think one of the big things that differentiates compared to marketing.
So if I understand that correctly, you're really looking at growth hacking as a mechanism for taking all the things that you're currently doing and optimizing them or making them better. Is that a fair assessment versus something like marketing where you're doing, you know, like content emails, search engine optimization and that kind of stuff? Is that correct?
Yeah, well, there is optimization is definitely an important part of growth hacking, but discovery is also important. So it's taking everything from discovering new channels, which would normally fit into marketing. So that part is still, I believe, really important for growth, and a growth hacker should be doing those things. But you should also be experimenting with what is that first user experience in the product? What should that look like? How do you get them to a really valuable experience with the product? How do you drive continued engagement? What are your different monetization levers for driving revenue growth? So it's really looking about what are all of the different levers that you can pull to drive growth of both customers and revenue in the business.
Okay. So with that in mind, what are some of the most common misconceptions that people have about growth hacking?
I think probably the biggest one is just that there's these magic silver bullet kind of growth hacks that you just go and pick a silver bullet growth hack. So that would be one. Or another would be that you kind of, it's about trickery. It's about coming up with ways to trick users to sign up for products. And sometimes it's just described as just really clever marketing. I think all of those really missed the mark. What I was going for when I coined the term was I was looking at Dropbox where I was getting all these resumes in with people, you know, having kind of traditional marketing backgrounds or even online marketing backgrounds. And they were so focused on everything a marketer could do or should do. And I knew from my own experience that there was a smaller set of things that really impacted growth. And then there were a lot of things that just were ignored by marketers or marketers didn't have access to them. They just didn't have the right kind of influence in the organization that are also really important. So I was really trying to carve out a description of what is really important for driving growth in businesses based on my own experience. And when I looked at companies like Facebook and LinkedIn that were also growing quickly, what were they doing differently? And how can we kind of make a description of a role that is more aligned with what really matters for driving growth in a company?
So it's really about looking for those high value multipliers, so to speak, right?
Right. And you contrast that where I had a lot of startup CEOs at the time that were reaching out to me and saying, hey, can you maybe come and help us get some awareness in our company? And, you know, I think that's kind of the one like big misconception of a lot of people in the startup world. It's like, oh, if people only knew, if we could just get some awareness, we would be killing it. But the average person sees 3,000 advertisements a day. Nobody with a little startup salary is going to be able to get any meaningful awareness off of just running a few advertisements and having people see them. That you build growth through experiences and through a return on investment where you're actually tracking your ability to convert and generate revenue. And that was another big part of it. Was marketers were kind of thinking like the CEOs, and CEOs who were trying to hire marketers were looking for those types of marketers. And you know, in both cases, they were really disappointed with the results most of the time. So you had this really high turnover in startups among marketers who were trying to take a traditional marketing playbook to growing a business, a startup, and just not very effective.
So is that the core audience for this book? Is it people who are coming in from a marketing position, or would it be useful to developers who are either developer/CEO or just like an engineer inside the company?
Yeah. So I think the reality of how growth works, whether people want it to kind of work this way or not, is that it's the collection of kind of all of the things that people are doing in product, which includes the engineers, which includes salespeople, which includes marketers. And really, they should be obsessed around that kind of journey that the customer takes to becoming a valuable customer of the business. And so everybody who participates in that growth or in that value creation process should be interested in this book. And CEOs in particular should be interested, because it's how do you coordinate those efforts across a group? And we've really distilled that down to a process where you can effectively manage growth across the really powerful growth levers to expand customers and revenue in a business.
I did notice when looking through the book that you did have sections in there where it was really aimed at people who were trying to implement it. And some of your comments around that were specifically that you really need to have that executive level or management buy-in in order to make this stuff happen. Talk a little bit about that, because I've seen things in larger companies where to get anything done almost requires CEO approval. But is that the same thing in smaller companies as well?
Well, so yeah, the bigger the company gets or the older a company gets, the more set in their ways they are. And they're not going to be able to kind of break down some of those functional silos that are just kind of historically how companies have been built without the CEO really playing a big role in that. And so I think that's what's prevented a lot of bigger companies from really embracing growth hacking as an effective way to grow their businesses. It's really powerful. And so I think that over time that they will make the transition to more of a cross-functional, full customer journey and work all of the levers of growth. But in the short term, it's what really holds it back is basically a lack of kind of buy-in necessarily from the CEO. And then there's a lot of things that you can do once you have that to make it effective. And that's a lot of what we cover in the book.
So I guess to start with the outline for the book, you've got it broken down into two parts. The first part is the method of implementing it. So it's more or less a process, and it talks about building the growth teams, determining what your type of product is, whether it's a must-have product or something else, and identifying the different growth levers in the business, and then it talks about testing it. And then in the second half of the book, you refer to it as the growth hacking playbook, where you talk about hacking customer acquisition, activation, retention, monetization, and then bringing all of that collectively together to help create a cycle. Could you talk just briefly about what you mean by having that cycle in place and how that all ties itself together?
Yeah. So what you see in really effective growth organizations and growth companies is that they end up really building a rhythm around growth where they understand sort of how growth works within the business. What are the key drivers of growth in the business? And they manage those and continue to optimize them. But as a team, they're constantly figuring out new ways to enhance growth. So it's basically analyzing the situation, prioritizing all of these ideas that they can generate to improve that situation, and then running those tests, and through the tests they learn. And so continuing to just run this process that helps them learn new, more effective ways to drive growth in the business is ultimately the outcome that everyone should be shooting for. And what we've gone through in the book is how to really get all of the pieces in place to where you can get into that really high testing tempo rhythm as a team. That's a common element that you see across all of the really fast growing companies.
So that's really like a systemization of growth hacking, so that you put all these different pieces in place and then you just repeat them as quickly as possible, right?
Exactly. And you're just accelerating that flywheel of growth. And that comes from a deep understanding of how growth is working. And through testing, you just keep learning new, more effective ways to drive growth. And you also learn what doesn't work through the testing, because not everything is going to be successful when you're testing it. But every test that you run, you get smarter about what it takes to grow your business.
Could you talk a little bit more about like the types of things that fail? And one of the things that I've heard from people, or their criticisms of the whole concept of growth hacking, is that they're like, oh, there is no silver bullet. You know, you can't just growth hack your way out of anything. It doesn't work that way. And I think to some extent, the critics are right when you phrase it in that particular way. But I also think that it's important to realize, like, not everything's going to succeed, or there's going to be situations where you don't have a clear understanding of whether something is even working. Is it moving the needle for you? Can you talk briefly about those types of situations, and how do you recognize those?
Well, so the first part that we really cover in the book that's a critical prerequisite for growth is making sure that you have value in the first place. And so if growth hacking doesn't work, or if you get kind of fleeting spikes of growth and then it comes crashing down, it's usually because the finish line for the customer is not a worthy finish line. There's no reason to stick around and keep using the product. And if you can't retain users, it's very hard to grow a user base. You're basically just replacing customers month after month. And in a SaaS business, you really see the pain of that. In other businesses, it might be less clear. So that's the starting point. It's just making sure that you have a product that's a must-have for users. And then once you understand that, it's about breaking down that path that gets people to that spot of becoming a must-have user, and then figuring out ways to improve the journey from consideration all the way to saying, gosh, I can't live without this product. And so it's really, when you talk about like silver bullets or just hacks along the way, we definitely are not recommending that, you know, here's six things to do that are going to work every single time. I think there are certain principles that help govern what's going to work and what's not going to work. So like if you read Cialdini, there's some really good kind of examples of just human behavior. But the individual programs and experiments that you run, you don't know if they're going to work till you run them. And so you need a really good process for prioritizing which ones you're going to run and being focused on the area of your growth engine that should have the most focus because you have the most opportunity for improvement.
That makes a lot of sense. So the thing that I really wanted to drill into with you on this episode was the idea of hacking customer acquisition. And you and I talked before the podcast about identifying something that our listeners are probably not going to hear in other places. And so in digging into the hacking customer acquisition, one of the examples that you threw out was Dropbox. That's kind of the first example that I came across in that section. And the commentary in there was that their initial cost of acquisition was around $400, but they were only making about $100 per user each year. So clearly, like, they need to find some other acquisition strategy to make that type of business work. Can you talk a little bit about that process of identifying what was going to work for them? Because you were there very early on in the process for Dropbox. So it's not as if, you know, you weren't directly involved in this. It's not a historical look from an external source. I mean, you were right there.
Right. And that's one of the great things about the book is we do bring in a lot of examples from other companies and, you know, talking with other growth leaders. But a lot of it is based on my own experience and what I've done specifically in these companies to drive growth, and Dropbox in particular. What we wanted to do with Dropbox was kind of explore the edges of possibilities around different channels. And so we did do some exploration in basically the Google AdWords kind of paid search marketing just to see what did the economics look like there. And we quickly saw that the economics were not good in that area. But at the same time, we saw that there were all of these other great opportunities for growing the business. And the one that was working literally. So I started the week that Dropbox launched at TechCrunch, kind of the equivalent of TechCrunch Disrupt. I think it was TechCrunch 50 at that time. But they launched the product. They got some good momentum. They had pretty good user base during the beta. But this was when it first became available to the public. And what I saw was there was a lot of passion for the product in that early user base. And so that was one of the first things that I did, was just how can we tap into that passion to grow the customers, and really trying to just break down how is growth happening already. And what one of the things that we did was we found that growth was coming through a number of channels. So like if somebody wanted to share a file inside Dropbox, that was pretty effective. Somebody would share a file, the person on the receiving end would click on a link to get the file, and then they would be able to lightly experience Dropbox. And so there was a small flow of people coming in from that. There were people coming in from shared folders. And then there was just a lot of natural word of mouth as well. And so it really started with just trying to understand what the motivations were behind those people. Ultimately, people who loved the product and were sharing just through word of mouth about the product, trying to understand those people. And then kind of connecting the dots. How do we get someone who discovers through a file share to actually eventually understand the 360-degree view of what Dropbox could do with that for them and end up loving Dropbox? So a lot of it was just documenting initially and then really capturing what was our data around each of those onboarding flows, and then a lot of surveys. I think I probably had feedback from, you know, hundreds of people every single day through different surveys I was running, just to figure out what were the motivations and ultimately perceptions that people had throughout the journey, depending on each of these paths. And then that informed our ability to prioritize where should we start experimenting first to try to increase those flows. So not just increase people coming in through those flows, but how those people actually convert and become those active users on the product.
So what were some of the leading indicators that you used to determine that you wanted to hack the acquisition process versus like activation or retention or monetization? Because, I mean, you said you'd experimented with the acquisition through paid ads and clearly it wasn't going to work. But what was it that pointed you in the direction of acquisition versus those other channels?
So we really didn't just focus on one. We were optimizing across the full path, but the starting point was just figuring out how are they discovering this product? And depending on the path that they came in, understanding what were their motivations on that path. And it just seemed like the good opportunity initially was what could we do to... So in a sense, you actually could say that we were probably more focused on activation for those channels initially. And then as we improved that activation, then we started to think, how can we get people to share more files? How can we get people to do more folder sharing? And ultimately, we built in an incentivized referral program so that people even started to just do natural word of mouth more often. But we built kind of incentives across each of these paths that were already happening, and that really helped to accelerate them.
So you just talked about how you had done like a lot of surveys and you had hundreds of them coming in every day that you were looking at and trying to parse through. What was it that you were trying to find with those surveys?
So first thing I'm generally trying to figure out is intent. So like intent is this really powerful force for a marketer to work with, and marketers have their own agenda and they're like, love me for this, but this other person is like in strong momentum looking for something specifically. And so it became really important to understand what that intent was. And then we were also trying to figure out at which point did they realize that they wanted the product more? It was more than just wanting the file that somebody had shared with them, but they wanted the product for sharing files. And so really trying to understand what that transition point was and kind of crowdsourcing it with people who were making that discovery on their own. And the more that we understood those people, that gave us a clear picture of what was happening. So one of the things we kind of experimented with early on was very quickly, depending on whatever their intent was, telling them about all the benefits that they could get from Dropbox. And when you think about it, like probably the biggest barrier to adoption for a technical product is complexity. That's probably more of a barrier than even price. And so like just giving them a list of all the things they could do with it was actually causing a lower conversion rate than when we really kept it focused around what their intent was and tried to convert their intent first and then ultimately give them more of a 360-degree view of the product once they were more locked in on what their initial intent was.
Is that something you would generally recommend for most businesses, especially when they're starting out? Because it seems to me like the place that most people start when they're launching a new product is they're, you know, focused on the features page. And then everyone's like, no, you don't want to do that. You want to pitch the benefits. And of course, from there, it's like, okay, well, now, instead of the benefits, what is it that people are actually trying to accomplish?
Yeah. So again, this idea of like test, experiment, that's what you see kind of through this whole process. But so initially, what I'm trying to do in a company is like kind of get out of my own head and just get enough people coming through the funnel so that I can try to figure out who is going to stumble into what the product does that's really valuable to them, and you know, get outside of those assumptions. Because I think it's really hard to guess that ahead of time. You can have a bit of a vision as you build a product, but a lot of the most successful products end up being valuable for kind of unintended reasons. We definitely saw that at LogMeIn, for example. So the benefit that I had with Dropbox was through the beta, the team had done such a good job to build a flow of traffic coming in there that I didn't have to focus on building the initial flow. I could right out of the gate focus on understanding the flow. So the place where I actually start, like at the heart of things, is I find the people who absolutely love the product, and I'm able to uncover that by just asking existing users on the product that are using it pretty regularly, how would they feel if they couldn't use the product anymore? And I'm trying to hone in on the ones that would say that they would be very disappointed without the product. And when they say that, that tells me that like they've discovered something so valuable that they're not going to churn. And they're telling me that they consider this a must-have if they would be very disappointed without it. And so understanding that, that's going to give me the key to basically being able to build an overall benefit or promise of what the product will do for people that sets the expectation on what the product is truly great for. And I think that's one of the mistakes that a lot of marketers make, is that they initially kind of build that promise just on their own gut or on the founder's vision or whatever it might be. But if it's a promise that's not aligned with what the product is truly great at delivering, it's going to attract the wrong type of people who aren't viscerally passionate about the product. So start by understanding what that must-have experience is, figure out the benefit that reflects that experience, and then working externally to get that into the messaging to set the right expectations goes a long way in just building a more passionate customer base and starts to inform those customer acquisition efforts as well.
So when you're trying to, hone in on what that compelling message is, like, is that the place where most people should be focusing their efforts early on?
So it really depends. Like I said, I had the luxury at Dropbox of already having a decent flow of customers. So early on for most companies, it's the initial efforts are, how do I actually get any kind of flow of customers into the product? And so that can be a really manual process. I wouldn't obsess over ROI at that point. I think that's another mistake that people make in the very early days, is they're trying to tweak the economics of that customer acquisition. I would essentially say, this is my learning budget originally. And sometimes you don't even have to spend anything at all. You can get more through just manually going out and recruiting users. But it's not about trying to find that big scalable channel that's going to pay, you know, give you a great return on investment. Early on, you're just trying to convince some people to come in and experience the product so you can figure out if you have something that's worth them sticking around on. And if you don't, then you have to kind of hit the reset button in the business and kind of go back to square one where you're working on product market fit. But assuming that you do have that, then you can basically start to, what I would do from there is then start to optimize that first user experience just enough so that by the time that you're focusing on trying to get the economics right in some channels, that you don't have something that like it's just so convoluted to get started with the product that you're going in and you're trying to do those things with both hands tied behind your back and the odds are stacked against you. So you want to get the basic kind of low-hanging fruit out of your onboarding funnel so that by the time you start to do some channel testing where you're actually trying to find that scalable way to acquire customers, it has a fighting chance of working.
Yeah, and I think that's sometimes pretty difficult to go through that process and realize, like, hey, I spent all this time building this product and working on it, and it's really not making any money, and I would like to get to that point quickly. And the solution is not necessarily to throw a ton of traffic at it, because if it's not going to convert and everybody's going to fall out, you're just kind of spending a lot of money and a lot of effort for no good reason.
Right. So you go from this kind of period of when you're trying to get to product market fit, that's a super patient process. So until you've created something that people care about, that's where you're just kind of blasting a little bit of traffic at it, and those people don't seem to care. And then you're sending more, you make some iterations, you send more. But once you get that signal that it works, you do start to get some more urgency. Once you get the signal that somebody considers this product a must-have, then you do have some urgency about pretty quickly trying to run some experiments through your funnel to figure out where is it broken. And so things like usertesting.com can be super valuable at this time of just giving someone a task of trying to come in and sign up and use your product for the first time and being able to watch videos of them coming in. Super insightful. You can make a lot of really kind of easy usability fixes there. And then over time, you want to start to A/B test kind of different paths to go in there. But that requires a lot more traffic. So some of it's going to be more just the usability testing to get those initial lifts. And then once you go out and you start trying to build traffic and actually, you know, volume coming into the funnel, that's where it's a little bit of back and forth between acquisition and activation. So if you're really having a hard time with your acquisition channels, maybe you need to work a bit more on the efficiency of your conversion in your funnel and then go back and work the channels again. But it's a little bit of back and forth, but usually at that point, you're back and forth between activation and acquisition.
So if I were to ask you what sorts of examples of acquisition hacks that you've seen or that you've used before or that you've found to be extremely helpful in the early stages of a business, like what sorts of things would fall into that category? And I realize that these things are probably not going to be able to apply across the board to every type of business, but I think there's probably some common ones that most people could start out with. So let's kind of break it down and say, okay, if you're just starting out, what sorts of things would you try first?
So the first question I would ask in any business is there active intent for this product? Do people actually know this category exists and they're looking for solutions? Or am I doing something that's really innovative and there's the kind of nobody even knows it exists? In that case, you're not going to get any benefit from like going to Google and starting to buy some search keywords, for example, just because no one even knows to search for it. So that would be like the highest level is just, are there people looking for this type of a solution or are there not? If there are, usually a good place to start is trying to kind of tap into that existing intent. If there's not, then you need to get into kind of demand generation mode, and it gets a little harder on the demand generation mode. What's, again, very category dependent, as you were saying, it's going to be different for companies, but like in the marketing technology space, a lot of times a good place to start in that case on the demand generation, if people aren't looking for it, would be with content marketing, where you're writing about your vision for how this enhances the life of a marketer or whatever it might be. But if there's kind of some education where you have to set the context for your product, then content marketing can be pretty effective. But you can't expect that you can just write that content and people are going to stumble upon it. So then you still need to market that content. So it's this idea of you ultimately need to start to stack some of these things on top of each other. So probably, you know, staying with kind of the framework part that I was talking about initially, you're really trying to get that bird's eye view on what types of channels might be useful for this business. And there are so many choices that you need a pretty good process for figuring out, where am I even going to start with this? One mistake that I do see with a lot of people is that they kind of try to test all of them. And most of these channels are too hard to figure out. If you're just testing it like, oh, I'm going to spend 15 minutes trying to figure out this channel and I'm going to run one ad in there. Oh, it didn't work. I'll move on. You really want to narrow it down to one or two that you really think will be effective. Work that for a while. If it's not, then you have your backup channel and your backup channel after that. You're kind of working across to just ultimately your goal is to find one single source of customer acquisition that's going to work for you and hopefully scale.
So when you say work that for a while, kind of what is your, you know, mental benchmark for like how long you should be spending on that, or how much effort you should put in? Because I think most of the people listening to this are probably not in a position where they can just spend 40 hours a week on something. So let's say that you're spending 10 hours a week on it. Like, how long should you be running some of these experiments?
So if it's search, you can generally figure out if it's going to work for you pretty quickly. If you feel like you've got kind of a better mousetrap in a category where people are already searching, or maybe not even a better mousetrap, but just an additional mousetrap. If they're searching for it, then that means that they don't necessarily know a great solution. And so, like, for example, at Log Me In, search was a great lever for us. So we basically, we went out, we had a competitor, GoToMyPC at the time, that was spending hundreds of millions of dollars essentially promoting their solution that was a pretty expensive solution. And so we were able to basically draft off of that spend that they had, and we had a premium solution that was about half the price, and then we actually even had a free version that could soak up some of that demand that they were creating that their high price wasn't able to absorb. So if they, let's say they had a 10% conversion rate to a purchase on their signups, that meant 90% of the people were interested in the category. They just, the value proposition wasn't strong enough. And so there was a lot of search volume around remote access to your computer, control your computer from anywhere. And so being able to just buy those keywords, we were able to get some good initial traction doing that. Now at Dropbox, it was a lot harder. Like we did try to test some of the keywords as we talked about, like, you know, maybe, well, Dropbox is kind of like backup, but when we went and tried to buy the backup keywords, you've got these big enterprise backup solutions that were paying a lot of money to generate a click, and they had a high enough price point on their product where they could actually do that in a cost-effective way. And so a freemium Dropbox product just really couldn't compete on those keywords. So and that's kind of that initial part is you're just, I think in the case of search, you can generally figure it out pretty quickly. Facebook's a channel that tends to work for a lot of companies, mostly because if you think of Facebook, there's like 1,000 or more targeting combinations that might work for your business. So people in this city that are this age, that are this gender, that, you know, that like this product, that generally if you test enough combinations, you're going to find something that works. But even knowing how to test those combinations requires some familiarity with the platform itself. There's a lot of kind of complexities and tricks within Facebook to really kind of make things work for you. So your question of, you know, they don't have 40 hours to invest in figuring it out, then, you know, they're going to be competing against people who do have 40 hours a week to figure it out. So that's going to be kind of the trade-off there.
Right. But it sounds to me like your general strategy in those cases is to just drive enough traffic and enough eyeballs so that you can get the conversations going, so that you can ask people questions and start honing in on that message. And from there, like, that's your optimization strategy, is figuring out what the message to those people is, what will actually resonate. And then that allows you to drive your cost of acquisition costs lower because you're able to be more highly targeted.
Exactly. So you're just looking for signal early on. Like, gosh, we're, for every dollar we spend on this channel in this like pretty narrow targeting, we're generating 90 cents back on that dollar. Like, that's pretty close. Like, I'm, you know, we haven't done a lot of the optimization of the landing page and, you know, or maybe even the ad in there. And, you know, if you see that kind of signal, that might be a channel to keep working where, gosh, I've invested $150 already into this channel over here, and we don't have a single person who's signed up for our product or who's even visited our website. Like, there, you could have such low signal that at that point it doesn't make sense to keep investing. But that's part of the balancing act that you're playing, is that if you don't figure this out, you're going to fail. If you don't figure out how to acquire, convert, and monetize customers, you're going to fail. And so it is a high stakes game that you're playing and figuring these things out, but you have to be pretty driven and experimental in getting the formula right.
So when you're evaluating the different things to try, how do you decide which ones to go after first? Like, what's a prioritization strategy that people can use?
I think a good thing is just, first thing you want to do is just list out all the channels that you think could be potentially useful for you. And we have a couple of good templates in the book for helping you pick channels and prioritize them. But basically the main thing that's in the template that we have in there for this is, essentially looking at the channel across a number of criteria. So cost, targeting, control. So like, is it something that you have to do weeks of advance? So like looking at the control, you have to do kind of like weeks of advance in planning. And once it started, you can't stop it or tweak it. That would be a low control channel. A high control channel would be something like Facebook or AdWords, where you can hit the pause button, make a change, restart it, hit the pause button. You know, you can do that over time. Similar to the control would be your input time. So like if you wanted to test television, it could take months to produce a television ad that you would have to put onto television. So that would be a really high input time, where even if you were going to test like a banner somewhere, it still is a pretty high input time to just design a banner that kind of looks good enough that somebody might click on it, versus if you're doing a Google ad, you can literally write a Google ad in 5 minutes, or even a Facebook ad. It's pretty easy to pick an image and build a Facebook ad in just a few minutes. So that would be a really low input time, and that's important. And then output time would be how long until I know that that channel shows some promise. So how long does it take to kind of start to read the potential of that channel? And then the final criteria would be scale. So if this thing works, is it something that I can continue to invest in and scale a lot? Like radio would be an example, that if you can get radio working in one market, there's a gazillion radio markets and there's a gazillion radio stations. And so you could really make that work effectively if you could get it working, but you're going to miss some of the control and maybe the targeting pieces that we talk about on these other criteria.
Won't using these types of prioritizations kind of drive most people who are in similar places with their business into the same areas?
If there's an opportunity in those areas to generate a positive return on investment, I think that's fine. Like what I would try to weigh it toward is, what are new emerging platforms? What you're not going to have in those platforms, like say, you know, Snapchat's been around for a while now, but you know, the early days of Snapchat, you're not going to be able to just go download 6 articles on great ways to make Snapchat an effective customer acquisition channel. You got to literally go in there and kind of invent it. And so in that case, it's going to be hard, but if you can invent it, then you're going to have a bit of a, you know, a much less competitive environment in there because other people haven't figured it out. Where if you compare that to Facebook, yeah, it's, you have massive scale in Facebook. It scores well across each of these, but the downside is that there are super sophisticated marketers in there that are going to be hard to beat. And so that's, again, part of the trade-off that you're making.
Yeah, I think the two things that kind of stand out for me from all of these things that you've just kind of touched on is the fact that the iteration time alone is almost worth its weight in gold when you're trying to figure out what your marketing message is and you're just trying to drive eyeballs to figure out what's going on and why people are using your product and why they would and what resonates with them. And then the second thing is that those emerging platforms, partly because they're so low cost at that point, people aren't really tapping into them. And I can think of a specific example of somebody who literally doubled their revenue from like $1 to $2 or $2.5 million basically overnight on Instagram marketing. And it was just insane looking at the graphs, and it was crazy how much.
Awesome. Yeah. Because there's not very many people that can effectively grow off of Instagram. So it makes sense that if you figure it out, you're gonna have a pretty unique opportunity there.
Right. And this was about a year before Instagram had any sort of paid advertising. They like figured out their own system, and like they had all these spreadsheets. It was really quite interesting.
So I have one quick example that really highlights the importance that you just touched on of why you need to get your activation right and some of the lower funnel things to make a channel work. We touch on it in the book, but when we first were investing in search for Log Me In, as I mentioned, it worked pretty well. There was a lot of intent for that type of solution, and we were able to scale to about $10,000 a month with a positive return on investment, but I couldn't scale beyond that. And when I looked on what was outside of my control as a marketer, I could see that 90%+ of the people who were signing up through my marketing campaigns were never using the product. So if they didn't use the product, they weren't going to pay us any money. So I wasn't going to get that return on investment. They're not going to tell their friends. So we're not going to get any of the organic growth that's really critical in companies. Just basically everything is based on them using the product. So I presented that data to my CEO. My CEO said, "Oh my gosh, you're right. We're going to have a really hard time growing the business if we don't get this first user experience figured out." And he put the overall product roadmap on pause, put every product person, every engineer on that first user experience to get it right. And within a few months, we were able to 10x the number of people who signed up and actually used the product, and what that meant from that channel in Google that had scaled to $10,000 a month, now scaled to $1 million a month. So if you think, like, for every dollar I was investing on some keywords, if I'm only getting 90 cents back, I would cut them. Now I'm getting $9 back on that keyword. If you just take that increase in conversion rate to usage and assume that follows through to revenue, and, you know, across all of these channels, suddenly search became this massive channel for us. And again, now that I had people using the product, they were going to talk about it and refer the product. And because we had a freemium model, that's one of the big factors in a freemium model, is that people should be spreading the word about this great deal on this free version. And so by the time I left LogMeIn a few years later, we had about 80% of our new customers were coming in through word of mouth. And so you take this $1 million plus a month being spent, and that's only accounting for, you know, a small fraction of the users, and everybody else is coming through this word of mouth. So that's really what we kind of talk about in the end of the book, where it's this flywheel of a bunch of stuff really going well. And that's the goal that you need to get to, but it's the interdependency of these different growth levers and how they work together to ultimately build a really powerful growth engine.
Yeah. And I will say, like, I've looked through, I haven't read the entire book, but I've looked through a large amount of it, and it is extremely dense. There's a lot of information in here. So,
yeah, I mean, my recommendation is somebody not try to read it cover to cover, but instead really, really kind of try to get the big picture of the book. The beginning kind of gives you a pretty good big picture, and then just do deep dives on a few of the chapters. Like, just really kind of try to, okay, now I'm going to be all about acquisition and really, like, absorb and read that chapter two or three times and study the graphs and study the other parts. And then after that, you know, and put it into practice as you're reading it, like, use it as kind of a study guide as you're working that part of the business, and then do the same thing for activation. But like, the more that you can kind of repeat and really drill down into the chapters, you'll actually get a lot of value from the book. Just cover to cover, it is so dense that it might be actually hard for a lot of people to read it that way.
So I think that's probably a good place to leave off. Do you have any other closing thoughts for the audience?
No, I would just, I'm probably the biggest one that I would just say is, again, this is super experimental. Just be prepared to test a lot and focus on learning from every test, whether it works or it doesn't work in the way that you intended. Get smarter about every part of the growth kind of function in the business. And if you do that, you will figure it out if you're really, like, dedicated to it and you absorb what you're learning through each test and just keep working to increase that cycle of testing, then that's really critical for growing a business.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Sean. I really appreciate you coming on today. If you're interested, the show notes will have a link to the book over on Amazon, and it's called Hacking Growth. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsforrestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.